You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius. Insane amounts of troops. Bring them to this base in Georgia, in the United States, and train them to basically go on murder sprees.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, same old Sean. This week, we have a chat with one of our favorite up-and-coming artists, Awkward. Awkward has been making some big moves lately, collaborating with the likes of KRS-One, Joel Ortiz, and Sean Price. But the most notable thing about him, other than his great rhymes, is his social conscience. He's long been involved in issues like prison reform and advocating for changes in New York State's draconian Rockefeller drug laws. That social conscience has found its way into his art, too, as he's created the first 100% nonprofit for charity hip-hop album with his Worldview project. We talked to Awkward about rap, politics, and all things in between. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL47. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further Outside the Lines. Now, here's Awkward. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm same old Sean here with Awkward.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, definitely. This interview is a long time in coming. A lot of emails back and forth.
Ins and outs, ups and downs, what have yous.
But we are finally here, so I'm glad to have you.
Thank you, sir.
And that nice bottle of John Daniels.
Yeah. How's he doing? Don't pretend you didn't have a little bit of it.
Yeah, very much. You know, we're in good terms. I call him by his nickname.
Yep.
So welcome. For our listeners who may not know much about you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and?
Sure. I mean, I consider myself a regular guy, so I think I got the same kinds of problems that everyone else does. Except, you know, one of the things that I was granted really made to deal with was kind of this incessant need to create and to relate. So, you know, the way that I do it at the moment is mostly through rap music. And, you know, I make my music based off of what's going on inside my head, and you know, inside your heads, inside, you know, around the world and, you know, in our communities. And, you know, try to make sure that that stuff's not preachy, but more stuff that we can enjoy and listen to. I make sure I got, you know, only music that people want to bounce their heads to, and try to make entertainment, you know, a little more, and try to make, you know, education a lot more.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you are definitely someone with a political and social conscience, you know, in addition to making, you know, fun, entertaining music. And I know you're creating a project that's solely for charity, right? Kind of a global rap album. I was reading something you wrote about that, where you're trying to get guest verses from 75 people from across the globe. Now, having been in hip-hop for a while now, like, I know how difficult it can be to get, you know, a verse from one person on the other side of Brooklyn. Uh-huh. So I can't imagine what coordinating something like that must be like.
Well, you know, I think that's definitely a side of this that really hasn't been looked into. You know, I have, it's to a fault. I, you know, when I say I don't sleep, I really mean it. You know, it takes three sleeping pills to get me just go to sleep right now. So, I definitely have spent a lot of time each day and many days preparing this. It's a project called Worldview. And, you know, it's got a couple different intentions. I think they're both, you know, definitely on the way in achieving those already. And, you know, the album doesn't come out until, sometime this year through DJ Booth. I guess I'm trying to, you know, not every song on the project is necessarily socio-political. There's a lot of good, you know, hardcore New York City stuff on there. There's some fun party music. There's some love stories. You know, there's some shit talking. There's all kinds of stuff. But that's what hip hop is about. It's about life. It's not about, living only by God's will or by your teacher's will or something, or your cops, you know, your local police officer's will. In terms of 75 rappers, I hit that, I'm about to hit that mark, or I've already hit that mark anyway. And you're absolutely right. It's been intense over these last couple of years. The best thing you said was that, yeah, I can get a mix back from a guy in Malawi, Africa, sometimes quicker than I can get it back from a dude in Brooklyn who lives down the street from me. So there's a lot of different variables that play into it. I'm still waiting on a mix of a song that has been done for probably over a year now from someone in Brooklyn. So, right. That's the way it goes. I just keep on moving, and when I'm done, I'm done. And it's going to be soon. And, I think, the best part is that I'm already seeing all the positive impacts from it.
It's Rap Genius.
At the moment, you can get any single song as a single off of iTunes or Bandcamp, and 100% of those proceeds goes to an organization that, goes a step beyond the gun exchange, educating and empowering the kids, working to do that, not just taking the guns and giving them money and saying, go off and good luck, but actually, using Jesus, a friend of mine who formed the organization.
What is it called?
It's called Guns for Cameras. He was shot at 22 times at age 22 and survived. And wow. He decided in his hospital bed he was going to change things. And, he built himself up first. He hosted local rap shows in Poughkeepsie and did various things. Got himself to the point where he could start Guns for Cameras. And now using his story, along with Pharoah Monch, who's the spokesman for the celebrity spokesman, so to speak, for the organization, they've toured the whole country, meeting with colleges and trying to build this effort alongside all of these very important gun exchange programs. The second half of this thing being that, as you imply or inferred, we have every continent involved and around 20 countries. Most of the 75 MCs that are involved in some way are from America. There are a few that aren't. But the production comes from all over the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, Europe, countries that honestly, a couple I hadn't heard of,
right?
So that's the second part of this. It's connecting us all through hip hop, showing how universal hip hop is and how it speaks to anyone who's living life. Whatever that life may be. I think we're much more focused on drugs and partying nowadays. Everyone can do that, to varying degrees of excessiveness, based on money or other reasons. But there's a lot more to rap music. The reason that we do what we do, you and I think we do what we do based on some other things probably that we got out of hip hop when we were kids.
Absolutely. And I wanted to go into the, sort of stay in the political realm for just a second. You had a piece done about you in The Voice,
mm-hmm.
where you talked about being involved in, I don't know if it was still called it then, but in SOA Watch.
SOA Watch. School of the Americas.
Which, for our listeners who don't know, the School of the Americas, they've now changed their name, I believe, and are called something else. But, you know, it was a place where the Army would train essentially Latin American death squads. And every year, well, why don't you say what would happen every year there?
Sean's got it pretty much right. Basically, it was a camp in Georgia that the United States government created that somehow, you know, very few people seem to be aware of. And it was designed, I can't say with 100% certainty it was designed for this, but the way it has been used for as long as it's been around, pretty much, has and up till today, is to take Latin American and other non-American or non-United States citizen armies, insane amounts of troops, bring them to this base in Georgia, in the United States, and train them to basically go on murder sprees, to know how to silence their competitors. You may have not heard through the news, if you're in this country over the past 10 to 20 to 30 years, is just, you know, these graves being built, or these graves being discovered, these mass graves being discovered, whole towns being destroyed, hundreds to thousands of people just gone, you know, all the innocents across Latin America becoming invisible people, like Pinochet and the rest of them. We had a hand in that, and one of the most, you know, glaring places, you know, obvious examples of that is in Georgia.
Rap Genius.
Where we've trained them exactly how to do those kinds of initiatives. When I was a few years younger, I took part in a protest. I mentioned it in the Village Voice article. I haven't thought about it in a while, honestly. There are so many issues in this country that freak me out. It's hard to even, you know where to put your efforts and time. But I went there and was able to get across the barricades to get onto the actual base of, you know, this military base where they're doing these trainings. And, you know, we had machine guns pointed at our faces and all of those things. And fortunately, no one was shot or killed that day. It's hard for me to say what an impact we made. It still goes on today. But if we don't do these things, then there will certainly be an assumption that it's right. So we were able to get a lot of coverage from the press doing that and standing up unarmed ourselves to the military.
That era, I know you said something also about sort of the anti-globalization movement. I remember that era of the left very well.
Yeah.
And up until 9/11, which I think in some ways took the wind out of the sails, like, there was a real groundswell of activism around sort of loosely defined anti-globalization stuff.
Yeah.
And so I guess I was just curious, like, what your involvement was, you know, back then. This was, you know, for people who don't remember, sort of late 90s through, you know, again, up through around 9/11.
Yeah, I was involved in a lot of those massive protests, involved in some of the higher level academic discussions about these issues, not as a doctor or a professor, you know, but influencing, it's hard for me. I shouldn't say that. You know, I'm a humble guy. I was involved at the time, involved in some really serious discussions with the doctors and the professors and the ones doing the sociological studies and, you know, trying to provide information that hopefully is now being taught. There was definitely, as you said, something there. There's something to be learned from how big it got. I think it's so far in our retrospective now that we don't have a clue how big it was. But there were so many people at these protests all over the country, all over the world. And the ones that I was able to attend, you know, as far as D.C., were really quite incredible.
You were in D.C. at that
time? Yeah, yeah. Well, no. I never lived in D.C. I'm just saying that I was involved in various mm-hmm. efforts in this regard. And for that purpose, is the farthest physically, geographically I got was D.C. So the really big ones were in D.C., and it was really crazy. I mean, you're thinking about the Capitol here. I mean, this is where the White House is. You know, it's not that far away. It's a few blocks away, and every single street is blocked off. You know, the newspaper banks, like those metal things, and the phone booths, everything's thrown into the streets. I mean, there's no getting to work on these days. And you know, interestingly, it's not always great for people who need to get jobs. And I had a unique experience with that.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, before I get into that, I'll just say that I think the anti-globalization stuff is hard for people to really grasp onto, because it seems so, it's a lot harder to understand than anti-racism or anti, you know, profiling, like stop and frisk, you know, things that I really, homelessness, like, you know, things that are cut and dry. With anti-globalization, if you just say that, like, globalization from an economic perspective may have a lot of good opportunities there. You know, if you think about globalization and deciding that, you know, the United States or the UN or some group is making the decisions that this is the right way to live, globalization means that you go to another country and tell them that this is the way they need to live. So in that case, that seems wrong to me. I mean, we're not taking into account their cultural, you know, their perspective. So, you know, I think globalization is a hard thing, and I think that may have also had something to do with its...
Sure. I mean, the name anti-globalization is not exactly accurate, right? It's like anti this, like, very monolithic corporate vision of globalization.
And in that regard, if I think, you know, I think if there was one group that gained power within the activist community or academic community and just, you know, probably the way that you guys run your office at Rap Genius, like, ask, but you have this little study group here that, you know, your employees, ask them what they think. You know, ask the activists what they think. You know, all the people doing this on behalf of this overall effort. If you're running this thing, you know, there's probably a way to explain it and make it, you know, have a purpose, a greater purpose that is like palatable to everyday people, mm-hmm. you know. I'll quickly answer your other question.
Yeah.
And I think this is very important. I'm not somebody who is in raggedy jeans and, you know, I don't stink. I take showers. And I see what real life is about. I mean, I think people need to be realistic. You know, I'm not a hippie. And, by hippie, I don't mean nowadays hippie. I'm not super spiritual and hopeful and 1960s, 70s hippie. I was in the midst of this major protest and this, as I said, things are just flying into the streets. There's the traffic can't get anywhere. You know, the newspaper things and the phone booths, they're all in the street, and this lady is screaming at us. We ostensibly are protesting on her behalf. We want her to be able to get access to the right health care and to get a living wage. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, what she cares about is not getting fired. She's going to get fired if she doesn't get to work at 8:30 a.m. or 9 a.m. Only we, the protesters on her behalf, have blocked traffic. She's going to get fired because of us, and we were out protecting her. So I'm not sure what that says, but that definitely had a major impact on me. And the way I choose to be an activist today is to make music. And whether it's political music that's obviously political or something completely different, being an artist, as far as I'm concerned, that's the most important thing. Well, you know, I have a song called Cheers I did a long time ago that I love, you know, playing like about that, the bar from Cheers. That's nothing political about that, except the fact that I chose to be an artist. I chose to not, you know, do mathematics or something else. I chose to be creative and to keep that as a relevant thing in this culture.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, your relationship with hip hop is I think very interesting. Like some of the stuff you point out, I think just from having seen different scenes over the years. That song Before, you really had this thing that I'd never really heard anyone say of talking about the sort of Ruckus Records, you know, sound bombing era as, you know, which everyone sort of looks at as this great, fantastic golden age, as kind of paving the way for hipster rap, which those same people I think would look at with a little more of a jaundiced eye. And I was just curious about you coming to that kind of connection.
I think that's, you know, the reason that Rap Genius exists, to ask those kinds of questions, to read that deeply into songs. So, you know, I certainly respect that. You know, it means a lot. The way that I looked at it was that it was incredibly exciting being from Connecticut, you know, personally, having spent most of my time in Connecticut, with, you know, very close to New York City, having my whole family being from New York City, having spent so much time at Fat Beats and having met Ill Bill, and who was a major influence on me, and DJ Eclipse, who plays my records now, and it means the world to me. You know, having met them there, and you know, that was like the time that like Ruckus was like for me. You know, that was the start, and then kind of around probably when I was in college or something, Ruckus kind of was like the next thing, and I never knew at the time. How I never even thought about at the time how it came to be. I just knew that there was like a celebration of the music that I listened to always without any kind of previous celebration before. You know, you have R.A. the Rugged Man, like the old Eminem, you know, like Bahamadia, like Sadat X, like just, it's an incredible combination of people. And I loved it, you know, I loved the music. But as I got older, you know, and everyone splinters apart and does their thing, and Eminem is Eminem, you know, then years later I find out that Rupert Murdoch's son is the one that started it. And so that was really mind-expanding to me. I didn't know then if that meant that that God is good, and Rupert Murdoch even created a kid that was actually down, you know? Or did it mean that the whole thing was fake and, you know, it was all bullshit and it was created by a guy who somehow had some kind of hook into some other person and they figured out who are the right people to put on this and he never loved it, you know? I don't know the answer to that. But all I can say is that not knowing a damn thing, I say, we're not responsible for who made us. They're responsible for us. We didn't ask to be born. If our parents are rich assholes, if our parents beat the shit out of us, whatever it might be, if our parents were great, if we lived in the hood, if we lived in the suburbs, in the country, doesn't matter. Like, it's up to us. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's kind of where I'm at now with all of that.
Lightening the mood a little bit, in Can't Stop, Won't Stop, you called yourself the Charlie Brown of rap. I was just hoping you could elaborate on that a little bit for us.
Well, I'm definitely a lot, like, if you actually know me, I'm far lighter than it might appear. I'm usually smiling. I've had bad luck throughout my life, and like Charlie Brown, I just go through it. I just live. I just do what I can. Only, you know, that's in the midst of a song called Rainy Days, and it's the whole concept behind that is just, like, on my way to Rap Genius tonight, I get in the car, and, you know, I take one sip of a drink, and next thing I know, the guy is pulled over, and he's screaming at me in the top at the top of his lungs. I don't know, you know, part of it is, like, not English, and he keeps telling me, told me before. But I have a feeling he doesn't know what told me before really means in English, because he didn't tell me before. And later on, he said he used those same words, too. He never told me I couldn't have a drink. So, you know, he's screaming at me, and it's like, that seems like, yeah, whatever. But if that happens to you every time you get in a car or, like, anytime you move, you start to see a pattern. And you could either take that to be like, fuck my life, or you could be like, you know what? This shit's absolutely hilarious. And, like, I basically live my life in a state of, like, consistent, like, comedic sarcasm. You know, Rainy Days is a fun song for me because I mean, I have just been in so many shitty situations, and I persevere and I laugh at it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of people turning, you know, stuff into comic gold, you have a song with someone who's been on this, a guest on this podcast before. I'm one of our, you know, a Rap Genius, one of our absolute favorite people, Sean Price. You know, is
he's hilarious,
as funny as anyone on the planet.
Right.
How'd that come about? How'd that collaboration come about?
I basically met, if I remember correctly, I met Sean P through Fraud. I've known Fraud.
So this is Harry Fraud, the producer, who you've known.
Your whole life. Yeah. Well, not my whole life. I've known Harry Fraud for like 10 plus years, to say safely. And he and I have been making music for a very long time. In fact, there are ways to, like, find joints that he produced for me, probably on, like, iTunes and stuff. Yeah, it's so different. I'm different. He's different. You know, there was
Secret
no
Harry Fraud Files coming out, you know, coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, there was no, you know, you'll have to just trust me because there was no La Musica de Harry Fraud at the time. You know, he just was Harry Fraud. So, I'll be honest. I think that Fraud had done some music with P before. And we just knew that this was going to be a big song that we did together, Fraud and I.
This is a song, Bars and Hooks.
Yeah,
I don't know if we've made that explicit.
Yeah. And so I'm pretty sure, P came in through Fraud. So what we did was we waited. I didn't even write anything. We had Fraud's beat. We got the verse from P. And, you know, so I always find it funny when people have issues with one verse to the next on this song, since this was very, very, like, consciously constructed. You're like, I don't like the flow on this beat or on verse one, but I love it on verse three. I'm like, nah, like, we did this entirely on purpose, so either you like it or you don't. So we heard Sean P's verse. It was a lot of fun, as always, you know. And so I wrote my verse based on that. Then I was, it was like, I don't know, like something like around Halloween, like a year or two ago or whatever it was. I was kicking it with Static Selecta and ATG. And I guess we went to like, Static was DJing. And it was like a Kid Daytona party or something. I'd never met him before. So I was like, you know, this would be a perfect third verse. So I hollered at him that night, and he was in the studio at Fraud's in like the next day, recorded his shit, totally based on what we had done before, There, you know, if you listen, if you listen carefully, if you're a rap genius, you hear, you know, certain similarities from verse to verse. And so he did his thing, and we got the incomparable Shakespeare to do the hook, and that was that.
Cool. So as a kind of follow up, any funny stories from the video shoot?
I'm sure there were.
I saw that Ike Eyes was there.
Who's that?
Ike Eyes.
Yeah, he was there. He was. He didn't do anything crazy. He was just chilling. I think probably the craziest part was that I think that P and I went all the way to Brownsville to get P, and I don't think that the Mercedes bought like the tour bus like would come to Brownsville or something. Mm-hmm. So he and I were just like standing out there for a while in front of his building, and like it just like wasn't coming. And then we were like, "Fuck, man! Like this video needs to happen." So he just like yelled at some Jamaican guy, and the next thing I knew, we were like in the back of this Jamaican guy's, you know, beat up car. And that's how we got to actually right around here in Williamsburg to record the video.
Oh, nice.
So that was probably the best part. I mean, like the most ridiculous part. Like
sure.
The guy really was, it was hard, you know, for me to even understand some of what the driver was saying.
Sure. And I wanted to talk about your rap name.
Uh-huh.
Right? Awkward. Obviously, there's the pun, you know, WORD, right?
Yeah.
But being self-depreciating is not a common rap trope, right? It's usually, you're usually like the incredible or the great mm-hmm. or the best, you know?
Yeah. Well, I hope that separates me. I mean, that, like, when I'm funny, I'm not a stand-up comedian. Like, what makes me funny is just being around me and hearing me talk shit about myself. Like, I do it in a way that I think is enjoyable. It's not consistent. It's not excessive. But, like, the reality is that I know I'm imperfect. I mean, I think that the funniest part about the world is how egotistical everyone is. I mean, the bigger of an asshole you are, probably the more insecure you are. I mean, the whole thing's a joke. So, you know, I definitely want to kind of make people uncomfortable if possible. Like, you know, awkward is okay. It's okay to be awkward, you know. I guess, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I live this name because I grew up in a situation where I certainly felt completely out of place, uncomfortable. I felt like I was surviving, and now I'm in a great place, you know. And you know, I've had a lot of messed up things happen to me since graduating from high school or being an adult or whatever it might be. Overall, I'm in a good place. So I now do this. I now live this. I now experience this, not just for myself, but for everyone who is in high school or in middle school, who knows exactly what I know I lived with. You know, I try to live through them and have them live through me.
Rap genius.
And dealing with that awkwardness, a corollary of that for you is a willingness to say often uncomfortable things about yourself.
And right? Not just myself, but others. I mean, you know, I remember very vividly my mom, who's not with us anymore, say, you know, just make sure you speak in English to your college professors. You know, when I was about to go to Vassar, she thought I was going to speak in Ebonics to them. And, you know, I was like, Mom, how do you think, you know, I functioned, you know,
right.
Like
it
I know how to
code switching, you know.
You know, I know how to talk to who and when and how and where, you know. It's, you know, so that was always funny to me. I'll never forget that. You know, so What was the question?
Oh, again? Just about you know, being honest about yourself. Like,
Yeah.
So you have that line on Melting Pot, right? You say like, oh, I used to dream of being like a Native American black Jew, right? And I just thought that that was both like so perceptive of your younger self and so like self-depreciating in this really like kind of cool way. Like, not that many people are like, I don't know, would even say something like that. You know?
You're right. And I mean, that's what makes you guys special also is noticing those little things. I that is how I lived. By the time I was like 8 years old, like I knew there was something wrong with me. I was, unhappy about things that I had no control over that, you know, I would hear. And so it was like, you know, I wanted to just experience it all and just like, these are probably symptoms of a fucking lunatic also. I mean, but I wanted to feel it all and I wanted to, you know, so I dreamt it like, you know, I would love to feel all of it. Like if I was Native American / American Indian, I would be like, fuck everybody. This is my land. Literally 100% of you, if you're not, you're wrong. And then, you know, if I were black, I'd be like, every white person, slavery, you're wrong. And I don't know what it's like to be these things. I just know what it's like to be born in this skin that I didn't choose. And so I definitely felt like a combination of white guilt / you know, I don't give a fuck what I do, actually. Like, I don't care enough about myself to focus entirely on myself to make money just for myself. I want to kind of correct this as much as I can.
Okay. Wow. And on a related note, I saw that you were just on a panel about Jews and hip hop, and I thought that was so interesting in that, like, that is usually something that's either subtextual or comes out as a joke. And I was curious what it was like or if you learned anything being in a conversation specifically about that.
Well, just to clarify, it was exactly as you put it, but I wasn't on the panel.
You weren't on the panel.
No. Okay. Ylove, who has turned out to be not just an incredible MC that did a song with me about like workers' rights and the 99%, called Mr. President. He's a black gay Jew and a rapper. I mean, I think to be that brave is just really quite remarkable. He's putting himself up to a lot of, you know, shit. If I remember things correctly, it was basically this Jewish rapper and a bunch of really dope organizations put on this show that you must have heard about, this conference, and they were talking about Jews and hip hop and you know, everything as you said, but I guess you know, Shy 360, who's part of my project Worldview, he's, you know, the man in Israel. He's like the Israel rapper, you know. He, I know, was there. And then Brimstone 127, the guy in Florida, who's on Radio 2.0 with me and KRS-One, that guy was there. And Ylove, as I said. So I'm pretty sure it was Ylove, but somebody pulled up, for somebody, the beginning of their talk was the People's Champ video. And even though I wasn't there, I think this leads to a very interesting conversation. I was really surprised that my video for the People's Champ would be the way that any of these artists, activists, Jewish rappers, any skin color would begin their thing, even if they'd worked with me or any other reason. But I guess what it showed to them was exactly the way I saw Ill Bill when I was a kid. Like, a tough Jew who doesn't give a fuck. Mm-hmm. Like, and I guess that is how I started. You know, that is what the People's Champ is about, you know. Representing where we came from, representing awkward, all the awkward people, and so I imagine, having seen that that's how he started, that he used it for that reason, to show that, like, you don't have to be afraid, like, just be yourself and figure out, always be yourself, figure out how it works into, you know, everything else.
Awesome. And I was curious about something, your Remnants and Rejects project. What is it like working in a for our listeners who don't know, that's more of you working with a kind of almost dance or EDM or electronic music producer.
Yeah, what was that?
Yeah, what is working with that kind of music? What does that allow you to do that a more sort of traditional, you know, hip hop vibe wouldn't?
For any artist listening, it's just should be part of your understanding that you consider any opportunity that comes before you. You know, I have a really probably unfair amount of beats in my library that I'll never get to, unfortunately. But I take everything that's sent to me. I take every concept that's sent to me, and I try any chance I can to, like, get involved in it and consider it, you know, think about it is good. I think, you know, being diverse is good. So, you know, I enjoyed this stuff. It's not like, you know, I'll be honest, I don't listen to myself over my beats or Fraud's beats. I don't listen to my Remnants and Rejects project. I don't listen to this guy's music. Like, I listen to a completely different thing that, you know, but when it comes to, like, what I think some kind of music should sound like how I want to be represented, like, for anyone who's a fan of me, who likes the music that I make, you're not going to see much difference, but I think you might be like, whoa, like, this actually works. Like, you might get into a whole nother kind of, like, subgenre of music. That's kind of how I felt. Like, you know, I didn't know I could rap over this, but apparently I can, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And so what's going on with Awkward now? You're working, like you said, on the global record.
Yeah, I'm very close to being done finally after a really excessive amount of time. You know, we got another Harry Fraud joint with Voli and the Incomparable Shakespeare coming soon. Another song that I think I sent you with Joel Ortiz and Slug from Atmosphere coming soon.
Two of my favorites.
Yeah, me too. You know, I would say, like, although I have a few more things that I need to record, most of the work that I'm doing right now are guest verses. Like, people are asking me to do verses for them, which is a great sign. I'm really close to being done with this. We're going to put it out through DJ Booth, as everyone knows. You know, I will say we have the Red Tag Society, which has kind of not been shared before. Like, they're a new sponsor of Worldview. That's the Levi Jeans blog. And we're just trying to kind of expand this as much as we can and really hit people, because there's so many types of variations on the music we all love. I think there's a lot there.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing all of it. And
thanks,
so this is Same Old Sean Outside the Lines here with Awkward, and thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, brother.
All right.
All right.
That was our chat with Awkward. If you enjoyed what you heard on Outside the Lines, visit us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you'll never miss an episode. While you're there, make sure to leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get awesome guests like Awkward. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
And I see what real life is about. I mean, I think people need to be realistic. You know, I'm not a hippie.
It's produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He didn't do anything crazy. He was just chilling.
Our music is by Psionic.
You know, shit. he...
And the creator of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
You know, then years later, I find out that Rupert Murdoch's son is the one that started it. And so that was really mind expanding to me.
We'll see you in 2 weeks, and we'll see you outside the lines.
I think someone loves you.
Who's that?
I'm going to find out in a second.